for Catalog and Cocktails, your honest, no BS, non-salesy conversation about enterprise data management. With tasty beverages in hand, I'm Tim Gasper, joined by Juan Cicada. Hey, Juan.
Tim, how are you doing, man? It is awesome to do this very special episode because, one, we have two people, which I believe this is the first time we've had two guests at the same time. Number one. Second, we have Amali Child back, so she's welcome to the two-timer club of Catalog and Cocktails. And third, librarians. I truly believe we need more librarians in our data world, and I'm super freaking excited to have this conversation because I've really, really, I mean, we'll talk about Amali's back, but Jenna Jordan is on our podcast. Finally, Jenna, you are somebody who've been following for a long time. You are such a huge kind of huge advocate for everything in the for librarians in for the data space. You do so much in the DBT community. You are bringing that different perspective. Thank you so much for being on the show. How are you all doing today?
Happy to be here.
Doing all right.
Awesome. All right. Well, kicking off Tell and Toast, we are honest, no BS, we are recording this one and it's still in the morning for us. But what are we drinking and what are we toasting for? Or what's your favorite new drink right now? I don't know. Who wants to go first?
I can go first. I'm on my second cup of coffee, which is maybe inadvisable. Let me know if I'm talking too fast. But yeah, and I'll toast to my 2008 Honda Fit, which just passed inspection yet again. This is a commemorative mug that our friend Hadley made. And it says, witness the fitness.
I like that you're like, I'm drinking coffee and this is my car.
Coffee's like, oh wow, that's one of my other favorite shows, Jerry Seinfeld, Coffees and Cars. You ever seen that?
Oh, drinking cars and coffee and cars. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Oh, there you go. Jenna, how about you?
I've got a matcha lemonade here with me. Also need caffeine in the morning. And let's toast to bringing more librarians onto data teams.
I love that. More librarians on data teams. All right. I guess we're all drinking coffee today. And then I am on weekends. I'll probably put a little bit of Bailey's on mine. That's actually a fun thing. Yeah.
Finding the cocktail twist.
All right. So much to discuss. Let's kick it in. Let's kick it off. What do y'all mean by think like a librarian for data teams?
So that the title for our talk at Day to Day Texas, Think Like a Librarian, came out of one, we spent a long time trying to come up with the title. But we decided the central theme that we wanted to focus on was mental models, bringing mental models that we learned from library school and working within libraries to data teams. And that probably the most valuable thing that we could do for the audience was to give them another lens or perspective to think through. Switch out hats, switch out your glasses, and the more lenses you can look through, the more likely you're able to find something you can do to bring value.
One of the key message in your talk, which was something that I learned about, was this notion of the reference interviews and how that should be applied to that. So you had all these steps. This was very brand new to me. And it's one of those things is like, wait, that makes sense. It's kind of like that common sense, like, oh, I never thought about that. Oh, that makes, oh, this is new. Wait, this is not new. People have been doing this. So help us, both of you. What are these reference interviews? What is this process? So what is it from a library perspective and how should this be applied to data?
So a reference interview is what happens when you have a research question, you walk into a library to help find your resources, you walk up to a desk, it may say, have a sign over it saying reference desk and a librarian sitting behind it, and you ask them your research question. And then what happens next is the librarian kicks off with the reference interview. So you can think of it as like a structured way to have a conversation where the goal of the librarian is to discover your true information need. Because the secret is most likely when somebody comes to you and asks a question, the first thing that they ask you is not expressing their true information need. So you want to uncover the gap between their expressed need and their actual need.
I think one thing that's been cool to me about learning about this, and your talk was really great, is I didn't realize that librarians had such a structured approach to this. You know, like, call it my own kind of ignorance, right? Is that I just kind of assumed that when you go into a library and you ask a librarian a question, that they just kind of like happen to know what's in the library, right? And it's like, okay, good, this is a person who can point me in the right direction, right? But it's clear that that there's actually a much more methodical thought process on to not kind of be dismissive or just kind of approach it from the perspective of speed. Let me just kind of like point you somewhere and get you out of here. It's actually to this idea of the true information need in terms of what somebody's really trying to achieve. And you know, one of the things that when you said that, it triggered for me was this, the concept of the five whys, where you're always trying to really understand what's the motivation behind the motivation. And so that's really cool.
And that is sort of the thing about the mental models and thinking like a librarian is I find that as you go venture outside the world of actual librarians in the community, you find that people underestimate the thought that goes into having a library function and be effective and bring value to your community and serve it well. And so sort of exposing some of these structured ways of thinking to data folks gives them a toolkit. And I think that the comparison between kind of data platforms and libraries that we talked about on the last time I was on gives you kind of that mapping for these frameworks over to the practice of data. And I think a lot of data practitioners often have had that experience of having someone come to them and finding through the process, like trying to serve something up quickly and then find out that wasn't quite the right thing. And so if you could have front-loaded some of that conversation, kind of skipping that rework, that is sort of the function of the reference interview. And I will say part of the skill of the reference interview is knowing when somebody comes up to your reference desk and asks for a specific book, not to launch into a reference interview necessarily, because they probably do know what they actually want. So some of those quick searches versus some of the more consultative work is part of the art of the reference interview. You don't always need five whys. You don't even necessarily want to ask them why they're looking for that book, because that's sort of a matter of privacy. But yeah, Jen has put a lot of thought into kind of the structure and the.
So let's dive into all these steps and what the reference interview, because I'd love to actually learn is if we go through like from the librarian perspective, and then kind of you all map it to like how this applies to the data folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first step is you're establishing contact with the person who is asking you this question. And let's assume that they're coming to you with just a non-specific research question, or maybe a question that could be interpreted in many ways. And so the example that I used in the talk, which is kind of funny, is somebody walks up to the librarian and says, "Can birds fly?" And so it's like one of those things where, okay, the emotional presence that you have, the approach that you take to the person matters, because you want them to trust you. They're going to slowly reveal more of what they actually need to know as they trust you. And so key attributes to remember: empathy, curiosity, and non-judgment. And so the first step is just to listen to what they say. No interruption, no judgment. And then the second is to paraphrase the request back to them. In this example, it's, you know, a little bit short, but if it were a more complex research question, you would want to say it back to them and be like, okay, in this reframed way, is this what you're asking for? And it's important to remember to have patience. And we're going to start practicing some active listening skills. So after you reframe and say their request back to them, you're going to start asking open-ended questions first, followed by clarifying closed-ended questions. So that's where the active listening skills come in. And so a question that you may ask this person who asks, can birds fly, is, are you asking about a particular type of bird? And they may say, oh, I'm interested in, like, for my pet parrot. Like, oh, okay. So where are you wanting to fly? I was like, oh, I'm traveling across the country to visit some relatives. It's like, okay, maybe the question isn't the obvious of, are birds physically able to fly? And you can, once you have, like, you've asked your open and close-ended questions, and you can restate the request back to them. It's like, oh, do you want to know if you can bring your pet parrot on an airplane with you to fly? And so it's kind of like a funny example, but it kind of, I think, shows the importance of, don't make a judgment, don't make assumptions. Your goal is to remain open. There's a certain humility as well to thinking, okay, my first assumption, my first thought on what this means is not necessarily the right one. I need to be open to many options.
The main take, one of the important things I'm taking away from this is, the first thing is, could be ambiguous. And I think this is like, in this new AI world where people are chatting all the time, like, I think this is kind of even more and more important, because there's, like, traditionally we've had, like, data teams, like, being the reference that helped us. I'm looking for this data, right? I go to my catalog to go find it. I'm just going to go Slack or send the team message to folks. And they're not going through that process, and they may be making assumptions and stuff. And then later on, they'll find out, like, that's not what I needed. So you waste all this time. But now, like, we're just going to our AI agents, and then we're a lot of time just getting an answer back. And we have no idea about this entire reference interview process, like, that the agent should have. And I remember bringing this up to you before. It's like, this is, like, should be almost like the pattern that agents today should be able implementing today, should be able to implement, because you want to have this type of reference interview to make sure, hey, is this what you really meant? Because I have, there's different ways of interpreting that. I'm curious to get your thoughts about this.
Yeah. So there's two more steps, but I'll pause and address this first. So during the talk, I gave a reference, a shout out to an article by Hannah Lee Golden, who writes at Card Catalog, called The Reference Interview You're Not Having with ChatGPT. And so to kind of reorient, it's not necessarily that the agent should be conducting this reference interview with you so much as, if you learn how to go through this process for yourself, you can arrive at a much more specific request that you need to fully articulate all of the context and remove all of the ambiguities from your request. And I do think that the human element is extremely important to the process of the reference interview. So I'm a little bit hesitant to offload that to the AI. I think that it takes a lot of skill and expertise to go through the reference interview, even if that doesn't seem readily apparent. Because the next step, right, after you have clarified your request, you know what you're looking for, is to then actually search for the resources. And that's something that you want to do together with the person who came and asked this question to you. So it's a collaborative process to search the catalog, search whatever you have available to you to answer the request. And this may look slightly different in different contexts, whether it's for a librarian's reference desk or on a data team. But you're using the librarians or the person conducting the interview, their expertise at navigating that information system. and you're using the interviewees, the person who asked the question, their guidance and their background knowledge together in a relationship to find these resources that can answer this newly clarified question. And so part of the goal here, like the librarian's playing many different roles throughout this reference interview, but at this step in particular, the librarian is also playing the role of instructor. And so I think this is often one of the missing steps or the thing that we don't talk about when it comes to self-service on data teams is you need to actually teach people how to use your systems and search through the available resources. And that's something that people learn by doing it together with you rather than completely offloading it and saying, oh, you go independently search it. That sometimes it can be easy to underestimate just how much knowledge and expertise you have in being able to search that system.
So that's an important layer to this, that, you know, being a good reference librarian, or more specifically being a good reference interviewer, means that you have to be able to not just help them find their answer, but help them be able to find the answer themselves in the future, assuming they're ready to.
That's also part of the time-saving aspect of it. You're investing more time up front, but by investing more time up front, you are hopefully saving yourself time in the future.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the things I wonder, like, to try to connect this to how people are doing data today, is how much of that setup and that investment, or we're incentivized to go do that, mm-hmm. versus we're like, no, the promise of self-service analytics and all that stuff. No, here's this tool, go do it. Like, no, there's a bunch of enabling needs to happen. And not just enabling how to go use the tool, but it's this entire process that you're describing, right? So you actually need to do have like people who are dedicated to this. And I think that going back to like how teams are structured, you have the roles of data engineers or data analysts, right? And data scientists, and like, but who is actually taking ownership of having these types of reference kind of interviews? And that's what I'm not seeing. And I think that's what you are all advocating for. How you're talking to your colleagues, right? You're all on data teams. Like, how are you seeing this in your experience? Like, you're sharing this with your colleagues. How are they responding to this?
I think Amalia has some really interesting stories here from past work.
Also my first sort of 10 years in what I now think of as data, although it was also research more broadly, was sort of like a reference desk. And that was a team of librarians and within a financial firm. And so that was a more dedicated, that was sort of a formal recognition that there was someone to do this work and be an intermediary between a lot of the resources that were too expensive to enable desktop access across the whole firm. So we were a bit of an intermediary and conducting these interviews so that we could retrieve the right information from those more expensive sources. But, you know, increasingly the model, even at that firm since I've left, has shifted a bit more. I know they have a data platform now, and I think they're probably, that model has evolved. And similarly, at, you know, public libraries and all of that, the self-service enablement of, you know, an online catalog and giving people access to the stacks, you know, a long time ago, librarians have seen this shift as well in a similar way that I think we're seeing it on data teams now. You know, historically, I think in a conventional data team, that's the data analyst for a lot of the business stakeholders is the person who would theoretically, or the business analyst doing a lot of this work, understanding the information need from somebody who doesn't know how to navigate the systems themselves necessarily, and then might show them for next time. And that's a lot of what we did in that role, where we could enable self-service if they did have access to something, saying, here's how I found it, here's how you can get it for yourself for next time. So that sort of analyst role, we were called research analysts at the time. I think for data engineers and maybe analytics engineers, they may be conducting this interview with the data analysts. And it's where you see data product managers, they may also be conducting some of this interview. I think it's similar. Last time I was here, we talked a little bit about like the requirements gathering process and hammering that out and really understanding. I think that some of where the five whys can come in. So I see those three roles as kind of performing this today, depending on how your data governance team is set up and what exactly their role is. They may do some of this as well around data quality or other issues. Let's see, so that's where I imagine the skill set falling. And to your point, Juan, thinking about, you know, conversational analytics and some of those more agentic systems, trying to figure out how to ensure that, again, you can distinguish between a quick pull, pretty straightforward. I know exactly what I want and I want to get it fast. And like we were talking about earlier, I'm working at a much bigger company now than I ever have. And I understand that issue of scale of self-service differently now. But making sure that where there are those more consultative opportunities to uncover a need and to differentiate a little bit from just the rote answer. Like if we build our semantic layers and we know exactly which questions we expect people to answer and how we want them answered consistently across the organization, and if we can really nail that, that's great. And that's sort of the repeatable self-service of similar questions over time. Some of the experience that I had in my more reference-oriented role originally was through this process and through the research, collaborative research process, sometimes you uncover areas where you want to differentiate the definition of a term for a really good reason. And like, I'm not sure yet how you would design the AI chatbot agent interface to kind of uncover those opportunities to do something differently than before, or to explore the question of like, why isn't this data available? You know, I think sometimes they have a bias for filling in gaps where there isn't information. And some of what this conversation, this reference interview may uncover is like, why isn't something available? Is it because we didn't buy it for the organization? Is it because nobody's measuring it? You know, some of that is where a lot of the business value is, I think, as I see it. And there were some examples of that in the investment world where, you know, you've come up with a differentiated investment thesis because you've dug into the definition of some classification or some term and created kind of a net new idea, really, through this process. And so I think that could be lost the more of this we automate. But there's a lot that could, you know, there's obviously a lot of scale that it brings as well. So
I think that's a good lead into the final step. I'll get through to the final step of the reference interview, which is verifying that the true information need was met, that the right resources were found, that they found their answer or found the right lead to their answer. And oftentimes the answer is that it has not been met. And so you can either repeat that process, or you may have discovered that in fact you do not have the resources available to you to meet that information need. And so you would want to go through a process of reaching out to the wider network, because there may be somebody else out there. There may be another resource, another library, another team that does have that answer. And so you want to leave them with a direction to pursue next. And also you want to ask for feedback on the process and use that to iteratively improve, and also like take note of what somebody asked. And you can develop a data set over time on what people are coming to you and asking for help on, and what you were able to answer and what you were not.
That's a really key piece of the what can be lost in the self-service enablement, or sort of direct disintermediated self-service, where, you know, if you are an intermediary, you get all of this rich information out of this about what your collection is missing, what your system might be missing, like unmet needs. And there are alternatives for that. So for example, with online catalogs, you can look at what people are searching for and maybe aren't finding. You can look at those stats instead of having that conversation necessarily. And so I think, Jenna, I'm hoping you can remember who wrote about kind of looking at the chat search, the chat logs, basically, to understand what are people looking for. Like that's a new data source for us to mine, because otherwise the team will start to miss what are people interested in, what problems are they trying to solve if they're not involved in the process.
This was another article pointed to during the talk. So Katie Bauer on her blog, Wrong But Useful, wrote a post called The Next Data Bottleneck.
So this is interesting one. So the, on it's kind of a meta data set. It's like, it's a data set of the things that we know that we don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that is super valuable right there, because like, that's where we're making assumptions, right? That's where we know that there's maybe lost information. That's the stuff that can help us focus our energy. What we need to go do next. Right. So
funny enough, Juan, you've been connected to a lot of research around nulls, right? Which obviously is more of a data specific thing, but honestly has some semantics.
Yeah, these are right? missing information.
People interpret 30 different ways. Right. So Jenna, between what you said and Amalia, what you said, I think there's something interesting here, which is that data teams really need to take to heart, which is, you know, a lot of teams, they start to become productive within an organization, and they start to complain that, like, we're being reactive all the time. And they, you know, kind of fell into that trap because they, you know, needed to scale. And it's like, well, just open a ticket, right? And you're opening tickets with the team, and because you need a new report or because you need a question answered. And, you know, sometimes the surface reaction to that is, well, you know, we just need to be less reactive so we can work on the things that we really need to work on or that we really want to work on, which on its face sounds like the right thing, but can be executed improperly, right? Like if you're just in your silo saying like, well, we know what's best, or we got to work on the infrastructure. If we don't do that, then we're just going to have a lot of tech debt. You can easily kind of forget that the stakeholders were submitting tickets for a reason or wanted to engage with that team for a reason, because they have these information needs that need to be understood and interpreted as true information needs. And then on top of that, not just actually meeting that need, you need to then close the loop, kind of what you were talking about, Jenna, where you may be like, okay, I understand, here's your dashboard. Or, okay, I understand, here's the new machine learning model. But did you ever go back and check if it actually solved their problem, or are they using it? If they're, a lot of times they're not. I mean, how many dashboards have we created that they looked at it once and then they didn't look at it ever again for a year?
Right.
Why? Why didn't they?
Yeah. So this gets at something that I like to use the librarian perspective and definition of being service oriented to reframe, because I feel like it often in data teams, it's either you're service oriented or you're strategic. And I think that when people on data teams think of being service oriented, they think of like an IT service desk.
Yeah. I'm the help desk and I just got to answer the ticket or something. Right?
Firefighting reactive. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, that is not at all how a librarian might understand being service oriented. Your focus needs to be on your user. Mm-hmm. And meeting their information need, helping them. And there's also so much work that goes on in the background in order to more successfully, next time somebody comes to you with a question, be able to answer or be able to have the resources to help them find the answer. And so that's part of like the part of librarianship that often you do not see is around collection development. And so that's where I'm going to pass it off to Amalia.
Sure. Let's see. This is an extension sort of law of data enablement 3, which comes off of the 5 laws of library science that we talked about last time I was here.
Can you remind them the 5?
Yeah. Oh gosh. Let's see. So it's number one is books are for use, or data are for use. Number two, and I may butcher these in terms of the specific language, but bear with me. Every reader, its book, or every stakeholder, its data set. So thinking about empowering and enabling lots of different types of users, not just specialists. Number three is every book, its reader, or every data set, its stakeholder. So that's one I'll dive in on. Four is save the time of the reader or the stakeholder. And the fifth is library or data function as a growing organism. So rule 3 is about
for folks to check out that episode.
Right. Yeah. Or there's a post on local.
And your post. Yes.
2024. Yeah. Called the 5 laws of data enablement, riffing on S.R. Ranganathan's 5 laws of library science. So, and updating them for data teams. So rule 3 is about sort of making sure that the books you do acquire, the data you do add to your data platform or your data collection is being put to work. And if you prefer to think about this in terms of sort of portfolio management, we often call it collection development strategy, policy, but if you like to think about it as strategy, that works too. So just making sure that, and if I had a dollar for every time someone said, like, why don't we add all the data to the data platform just by default, everything we have, we should just bring it in so that we need it.
Fantastic. Yes, let's go do that.
That's for people who've never seen a Fivetran bill, I guess. So what you'd want to do when you stand up your library is be strategic about what you bring in. And there's, you know, a mental model and a process for that, or a few processes. And then also be strategic and proactive about what you decide to discard or weed in library terms. And so the collection development process starts with that question of your purpose. What is the business value you're going to bring? And often at large organizations in particular, you're not the only data platform or the only warehouse, especially through M&A and things like that. Over time, those things accumulate. So what is your sort of, how are you differentiating yours from the rest? And what is ultimately the scope and purpose of your data collection, your library, compared to the other branch libraries in your town, or, you know, resources like academic libraries or bookstores? What are you here to do is the first kind of step. And then for the stakeholders that purpose serves, what are their needs? And so there are a bunch of different methods, qualitative and quantitative, to go out and understand like what they would be interested in. And in organizations, like your alignment to different business functions is probably going to be a huge factor, the size of those functions and the types of data and systems that they are involved with or manage or use. So you're going to want to do all that research kind of on, and it doesn't have to be an extensive process. A lot of this is pretty straightforward and kind of repeatable from one organization to another, because a lot of functions are pretty similar, no matter what industry you work in. But you know, back of the napkin, what's kind of the denominator of what you could put in your warehouse? What are all the books you could buy based on the purpose and scope of your library? And then which ones are you going to go after? How are you going to allocate those resources? And how do you prioritize so that you can, you know, add that incremental business value and also grow a robust collection over time? One of the ways we use classification in libraries is to think about, you know, sort of domains. And there are both kind of subject areas and formats that play into that. So everyone knows the Dewey Decimal classification for nonfiction titles. Not everybody, but that's one of a few different classification systems we use. And so you can break things down within subject areas and say, like, for my population, they don't need a huge depth of information in this subject area, but they probably need some amount. We call it collection depth. And I also think about collection depth in terms of modeling. So like, you may just need source data for that domain because it's your data scientists, they want it raw, they want it big, you know, stop there. In other areas, finance, you're going to want to like model that to the hilt and make sure you have a single source of truth for different metrics. And so that's sort of another element I think of with collection depth. And then there's also formats. So you sort of treat in libraries things like periodicals and magazines differently than you do your nonfiction from your children's books. They all have like different physical characteristics, again, different population sizes. And so you have different sort of governance and management frameworks for them. So you're deciding how to allocate your resources. You're taking in information in libraries that's like, you know, book reviews. Your library may or may not take requests. What else? All sorts of, you know, usage statistics. As you start to build your library, you're going to be looking at circulation. So these are all indicators that librarians use against their budget and their physical constraints. So I know we think of cloud resources as completely unlimited and cheap, but there are in most organizations like budget constraints, at least, to think about where you're going to allocate your resources for a given year and so on. And so, you know, the product management discipline, the reference interviews, the kind of all that stakeholder engagement that you do is all work to inform what you're going to collect, why you're going to collect it, and why some other data platform at your company isn't going to be the one to collect it, potentially how those might be interoperable in terms of like interlibrary loan in the library world. So if they're going to collect it, you're not, great. How do we share it? And then thinking through like proactively, what are we going to get rid of? What's our policy for kind of keeping this thing fresh and relevant, because again, we don't have unlimited storage or budget forever, using some of those same indicators of nobody's using it, nobody needs it, let's retire that dashboard.
I feel like one of the hardest things in data management, product management, really anything is retiring or removing information or products. That's just always tough because, well, it's just sitting there, but there's actually a cost to having information that's stale or outdated or misleading or requires maintenance.
In what I love about what you just went through in here and connecting it with like the reference interview, somebody, if I play a little bit of like devil's advocate listening to this, I'm like, yeah, I get it, but this sounds too theoretical, too academic, and like, yeah, and it kind of is, right? But then you are just describing how you're grounding all of this kind of like the right thing to go do and so forth, but into like how this impacts your business. And like, we're not just telling you this is the right thing to do. This is the right thing to go do, right? But there is a reason why to do this besides the right thing to do. It's like, this is how it's actually going to help you ground your resources, right? Allocate your budgets. Like, this should be connected to the FinOps model. Like, how many people you're hiring? Like, what is the reality of how much you can actually scale for this stuff, right? Set the right expectations. And so this was really, really great. What I loved about this.
Well, if you don't mind me adding one quick comment, Juan, in case you're going to take it in a slightly different direction, is that I think one thing that's important that people understand, to your comment about this, you know, can feel a little academic or something like that, is there's actually really practical things you can do to implement what Amalia and Jenna are talking about. And I'll just name one thing, right? Like, I see too often data leaders say like that their roadmap, right? So there's kind of strategy and roadmap is like, well, we're going to do Snowflake, and then we're going to do, Databricks. And then we got, you know, we haven't really touched the Power BI stuff. So we got to do the Power BI stuff. And so it's very like through the lens of that database or that technology, right? When the data leaders that I see being more successful, their roadmap looks a lot more like, well, right now we're really focused on procurement because there's a lot of, you know, needs that group has that's very, very impactful short term on our revenue. And so that's our focus right now. So semantics, data sets, reporting, we're focused on that. Next, we're really going to be focusing on our pricing optimization strategy because we've got so it's much more focused on the business use cases. And how did they figure that out? How did that roadmap come together? Because they're working with their stakeholders and they're doing reference interviews and they're doing the road shows, right, to make sure that they understand what people need and do it within their budget.
Yeah. So a question I have here is on how generalist versus how domain specific. Librarians are in general, Java librarians are, and how this applies to organizations today. Because I'm having a lot of conversations with not just data leaders, like with investors and CEOs and folks, and they're like, we with AI, we are going to really automate a lot of this operational stuff. Which means that there's going to be less of that operational work you're going to go do, which I really appreciate how you separated. Like, there's service oriented is actually different from all of this. And I think you've actually made a great case that service oriented is actually enables you to be more strategic because, like, that's how I'm going to go figure out how to go scale things, right? And figure out where to go, what to do, and what not to do, because that's a strategic decision to go do. But then at some point, you're like, if we're all going to be more strategic, like, well, we can't be strategic generalists. We probably need to get more specific. And I'm having a lot of discussions. People are saying we need to figure out where to put our eggs, in which basket, kind of focus things. And you brought up something about like the collection depth, right?
Yeah.
How are you seeing today? Like, are folks going to be like pressured to be more domain specific? Like, going back to Tim's examples, like, I'm the data teams or librarians or whatever who are focusing more on pricing strategy, and I can go very deep into that stuff, not as much as procurement because of the other, I don't know.
Yeah, and that is a model in librarianship, right? So you think of public libraries as generalists, but even within that, you'll have, you know, specialists and, you know, for collection development, they call it selectors, or you might have, at a very specialized public library, you might have multiple reference desks or children's librarians. A lot of librarians actually have two degrees. They'll be librarians and have teacher certificates for school libraries, or in academia, they often have a master's in whatever field of academia they're specializing in. And so they'll be working in a library that's just for religious studies or politics or whatever, and they'll have that specialized degree. So that's a really well-worn idea in librarianship.
I'm laughing here because I thought I made an insightful question comment, and then you with your answer, I just realized that I'm like,
it's a great question.
this is the thing I come back as like, oh wow, yeah, think that, and they're like, of course we do this
all the time. Have thought about it. So my model that I came from in finance was, so it was a financial services firm, but it could invest in any industry in any region globally. So our coverage as a centralized team was, you know, anyone could metaphorically walk up to us, email us, whatever, and ask a question about anything. And so we had to divvy up across, you know, at the time the team was probably 16 people globally. We had a team in India that were our counterparts in to the Boston team, and we specialized by industry vertical. So I started to learn about economics and capital markets through that job, but which is sort of aligned to finance. But my coworkers were specializing in healthcare and, you know, consumer retail and tech and all of that. So that is a model I'm partial to, where you have people who are expert in information management or data management, and to some degree aligned. That could be, you know, centralized model, center of excellence, whatever you want, but they are able to specialize and grow their subject matter expertise, their relationships, that trust with stakeholders by domain. Because I do think, as we see, like business processes and data models and metrics and KPIs and business outcomes, like those are largely aligned by domain within an organization. But you also want that coherence of the data model or AI infrastructure and like data infrastructure. And you need that like bridge between some people who can carry the business context and also understand the technical implications. And I think that's pretty well served by kind of a hybrid or federated type of model.
Yeah. And I think librarians are going to find the approach of data mesh very intuitive and aligned with.
I'll never forget our chat, or Amalia was like, oh, wait, data mesh, like all this stuff. Yeah, librarians have been doing this for how many hundreds of years or whatever. So, yeah. All right. Well, as you see that we kind of took our route, like this has been a fantastic discussion. So we're just going to kick it off, go straight to our takeaways, because we didn't have time to write our
there's just too much good stuff that we were talking about.
Here. And then Tim's camera stopped working.
Yeah, my camera stopped working. Neither of my cameras are working, so I'll be the spooky ghost here. So first of all, we started off with like honest, no BS. What does it mean to think like a librarian? Like, what does that mean? And Jenna, you kicked us off by mentioning, so at Day-to-Day Texas, you gave a talk around really thinking about how to bring the mental models that you and Amalia and really all librarians learn from sort of librarian school information kind of management, right? That to be able to bring that to data teams so that they could understand the insights around that and look through that lens so that they can be better. And in particular, there's a lot of different aspects about library science, which is very applicable in librarians and what they do. But in particular, we zoomed into the reference interview, which is when you have a research question and you come to the librarian with that question, they're not just going to be like, yeah, go, you know, check out aisle five, right? It's really about, hey, let's actually conduct a structured way around this conversation with the goal to discover, and I think this is a great phrase, true information need, right? Like not just the surface need, but the true information need. Because usually when folks ask a question, the first thing they're asking is not truly expressing that, and you need to navigate that gap. And that's something that data teams face on a daily basis, whether you realize it or not. And it's so important because if you spend a little bit of extra time to really understand the problem, you're going to save so much time in the long run, and you're going to be so much more valuable to the organization. And Jenny, you walked through the key steps, which were to establish contact, right? So for example, if somebody says, can birds fly? You know, it's a very ambiguous question. And so as part of establishing contact is to create an environment of trust. You mentioned empathy, curiosity, and non-judgment. You want to paraphrase back. So really practice your active listening and reframe. Clarify the request, ask questions, start more open-ended, but then kind of get more closed and clarifying towards the end. Help them search for the resources collaboratively in a teaching way so that they become more empowered to search for the resources and be able to self-serve in the future. And very important, ultimately, you want to verify that the true information need was met. More often than you think, you're going to find that the information need wasn't met. And this is something that, you know, data people, governance people, analytics people, AI people have to really keep in mind, is that we think we're very smart, and we are, right? But communication is hard. Collaboration is hard. Really understanding the intent of people and organization is hard. Humans are difficult things, right? And so that means you have to iterate and you have to close that loop. So really, really good insights there. And then lastly, before I pass it to you, Juan, we were talking about how does this play out in data? You know, data engineers, data analysts, data product managers, even sometimes governance teams, they need to participate in these kinds of activities, these reference interviews, to really be more successful. Juan, what were your big takeaways?
Yeah, so I really like the whole service-oriented versus strategic that Jenna brought up. I usually think about it as operational and strategic, but the whole service-oriented is like one or the other here. It's I'd argue that they come together, right? Because your focus is on the user and you really want to understand what's happening. Next time a question comes up, you should be prepared around that stuff. And like that's how you scale. And that's a very strategic thing about, a very strategic aspect to think about. And then Amalia went into kind of the five laws of data enablement, and we've zoomed into that third one, which is like every data set is a stakeholder. It's about making sure the information is being put to work. Often folks say, let's stick all this data in the library, right? Like that's not going to go work. So what is the business value you're going to go bring? Like also often you aren't the only data lake platform out there, right? Because your large organization, they have different things. So what is the scope and the purpose of your library data platform? And how does it connect to the other branches, right? The other data platforms in your organization around that. And what could you do versus what will you do? And what is the strategy to grow that over time? We're talking about the collection depth, like how detailed do you want to go into something? It really depends on your domain. What are your engagement interfaces? Like how are you taking requests? How are you taking requests and so forth? And all this is important. So you end up thinking about how to manage the resources that you're doing. So this applies also like the FinOps and everything that we have. So they should go very tightly connected. And what are you going to collect? Why those things? Why you? Right. And what are you going to go and what are you going to get rid of? Because maybe people aren't using that anymore. And then again, talk about specializations of like, duh, that's what librarians have already been doing, right? So I think that's actually a lot that data people need to be able to learn from how librarians have already been doing this, which I think is the main takeaway of all this is like, hey, librarians, they've been doing this stuff for a long, long time. Not only pay attention to them, hire them. How did we do? Anything we missed?
Nothing. You missed something that I missed that I wanted to make sure to cover to that point of having that domain expertise and the importance of data or librarians having data folks having that domain expertise is because when you're conducting that reference interview, when you're doing the requirements analysis with a stakeholder, it is on you to take their business-oriented request and turn it into a data-oriented request and not on the stakeholder. They're probably already trying to do that translation. They may be making assumptions about you that that you don't know the business, and so they need to turn it into a data-oriented request, and that's where that gap is just getting wider and wider. So I really want to emphasize that it is your job as the data professional and not the stakeholders to dig deeper and discover their true information need before you try to fill it.
That's spot on, because I see this all the time. And then there's more assumptions that happen. And I think I'm doing you a favor and stuff, but sometimes you're not. And let's go. And at the end. That's a good point.
And we become obsessed about, you know, business people becoming data literate when we need to become just as equally obsessed, if not more obsessed, about data teams becoming business literate.
There is that empathy piece too of not wanting to discourage them from thinking they've got the data piece, right? Like if they're trying, like you want to encourage that as well, but also, yeah, stay focused.
Yep.
To wrap up, what's your advice? Who should we invite next? And what resources do you follow?
All right, I'll go through mine. Advice, I'll do three quick things. Do what gives you joy, find and build community, and then my personal motto that I feel like I have to remind myself of always is check all assumptions.
That's love that.
That's a t-shirt right there, check all.
I think my advice, which is also a resource maybe, and then I'll hand it off to Jenna for recommendations for the pod, is if you are not a LinkedIn person, and I'm not, do check out Substack. I think it's been really nice to engage differently with a lot of the same voices who have a lot to say in more maybe long form. I think Juan, you're on there. A lot of the big names are in data that you might want to read. So both advice and a resource.
And in particular, I think we both really appreciate Jessica Talisman's blog, Intentional Arrangement, and then Hanalei Golden's blog, Card Catalog. And they're both in that space of translating a librarian's perspective for data and AI.
And one I want to shout out in particular that Jessica wrote about provenance. And we talk a lot about data lineage and thinking about information provenance and how LLMs are handling that or not is really interesting food for thought.
Yep. Where provenance ends, knowledge decays.
I like that. And who should we invite next?
So I would love for the show to have the perspective of data librarians. Mm-hmm. I think it came up at the end of the previous episode that Molly was on. It's like, okay, maybe we need data librarians. Well, there are a lot of data librarians out there. And so there's two data librarians that I really respect and they're friends. So you should follow in the tradition of having two librarians on together. But Kristen Briney, she's a data librarian and a biology and biological engineering librarian at Caltech. She's got a new book out as well on data management. And then Abigail Gobin, who's a data librarian and now the Associate Chief Research Information Officer at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Awesome. Amalia, Jenna, thank you so much. This is such an important conversation that we need to have. And I'm really looking forward to like people listening and they're like nodding and like, yeah. And then following your resources and getting to learn more about everything that you bring to the table and help us, everybody in the data world. So
yeah, thanks so much for being on the show. And everybody listening, follow Amalia and follow Jenna.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. Thanks.
Cheers. For-